CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 143 with Dr. Rafael Vasquez Rojas. The best methods for beginners to become master surgeons. This is some great advice. Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. Today, I have a very special guest. I got Dr. Rafael. How are you, my friend? Dr. Rafael Vasquez Rojas is a very well-known ophthalmologist in Mexico City who has a big passion for teaching residents. And we had an opportunity recently in FacoFest in Oaxaca to do a lecture together, and I had so much fun. So welcome to the podcast, my friend.
Yes, today we're going to talk about teaching and the new generations. And I just would like to say that this is a huge opportunity, and I'm very glad, and I really, really, really appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Oh, my friend, my pleasure. I love the way you teach. I learned a lot from you. And I also realized you have a huge fan club there at the meeting.
Yeah, it's a shared fan club, because obviously the first thing that I say to my students is go and watch CataractCoach.com, and everybody knows it.
Yeah, for sure. Now, over the years, residency has changed a lot. And I think it's actually more difficult now, because there's so much more material.
Yeah,
it's harder to learn it. And there are even so many more different techniques, but yet the amount of training, the number of years is the same.
Yeah, for sure. I think teaching is one of the pillars of life. If we don't learn, if we don't teach properly, we won't transmit knowledge the right way. And if this happens, we'll keep having to go back every time we want to learn something new. So for me, this is vital. And we, as professors, I think we have a huge responsibility to transmit this knowledge the right way for them, because they already know so much things. So you have to keep up with that.
You know, we do for sure. But I mean, the big challenge is, like, when I trained, do you know, there was no OCT machine. There's no anti-VEGF. There's no femtosecond laser.
Yeah.
There was no phakic lenses. That none of these things existed. Or even now for surgery, all the residents learned cataract surgery, but they also learned MIGS. We didn't have MIGS.
Oh yeah, for sure.
So there's so much more to learn. So what do you find? What's the best way for a young surgeon to learn this? You're starting your residency. You have a mountain of knowledge that you have to learn. How do you start? And it's in particular, how do you learn the operating room? Because we all can memorize a book.
Yeah, of course.
How do you learn to work with your hands?
Well, I think there are lots of ways to learn something new, but specifically with the surgical skills, there is a very hard way to learn, because there are two paths. The first one is when you are super confident with yourself, and then you go to the operating room and you try it. But right. Sometimes that's not enough. That's not enough to watch a video and have self-confidence. So the other one is to learn by watching your mentors. And obviously this is the best way in some ways, because that's not enough too. You have to have both. Because when you watch a video, you analyze it, you study it, and then go to the operating room, then you have the whole package. In the operating room, you're not limited to see the procedure. You can watch your mentor's hands, how is he moving, mm-hmm. and you also can have some kind of feedback when you ask him, what are you thinking? What is your personal algorithm to proceed with this procedure, with this case? There are lots of new things, that no one in the world know to do, because they're new.
Right.
And there's a learning curve also for super skilled surgeons who know how to do everything that it's going on nowadays, but with so many things that are new in the world, we all have to stay humbled, because there's going to be one day when we won't know everything.
Oh, for sure. I don't know anything now.
Yeah.
I think there are two parts of it. On the one part, you have to be able to teach yourself.
Yes.
But then also, you have to be able to learn from your professors and your colleagues and your attendings who are going to teach you. So you have to do both. You can't just do one. Sometimes I used to have residents who would do no self-learning, and then just come with an empty mind and say, okay, teach me. But that's not sufficient. You have to do both.
Yeah, of course. Of course, because learning is always a process. When you know something and then you grow that knowledge, and there are not like these cubes where you used to, the cubes, these cubes with, like Legos, the ones that you play with. If you put them in the floor, just one by side by the other, you're going to just have something like, I don't know, something like plain and something that's not growing out. You have to pile them one on top of the other. And that's what learning is from my perspective. I don't know. It's something that is a little bit new for me, because I've always have this like of teaching, but I have been practicing it formally just 3 years by now.
Wow, you've done so much then. That's amazing.
Yes, because seems little.
Yeah, because right now you actually do a lot of resident teaching. So you were in the operating room side by side with the resident, and you're correct. There's more than just like the video. You may hold them like, no, sit like this, put your shoulders back, hold your hands this way. There's those little things sometimes you don't show in the video.
Yeah. Even though you have a video where you show it, but I don't know.
Thank you.
yes, it is amazing. But yesterday I had a very challenging surgery. We usually are divided by all these specialities, but yesterday I had a special invitation for one of my mentors from the uveitis room. Okay. This was Dr. Patricia Navarro, and she was like, please help me with the surgery. I have other things to do. And this is the case. This is a patient, 76 years old, with hyphosis. Okay. She couldn't stand. She couldn't get the right position. She couldn't be like totally flat. So I had to operate her like something like this, like with the hand, a little flexed. And it was not an easy case. It was like totally blocked. The pupil was totally totally
sinigate.
And when I was thinking, okay, but this is an uveitis cataract, it should be a soft cataract, but it was not. It was hard as rock, and I couldn't see anything. But my point here is, you have to stay humble, but because you know, you never know where is going to be this challenging case when you have to listen. From one point of view, I learned so much yesterday from her. She was telling me some things that she used to do in these cases, even from the with the fellow that was helping me with the instruments and everything. And it was a very rich moment for me. And I was thinking, how amazing is this? We never stop learning. And I think that's one of the greatest things in life for a surgeon.
For sure. I mean, that sounds like a very difficult case. So instead of lying supine flat, normally like we like the iris to be parallel to the floor.
Exactly.
But in your case, because of her bad kyphosis and she couldn't lie flat, so her iris is like 45 degree angle. And you have to operate.
Yeah, and I was thinking about that, because my back was like a letter S, because I'm not used to operate temporally. So I didn't know what to do with my knees. My knees were striking with the table, and it was a very uncomfortable moment for my body, but to my mind and to my, I don't know, my spirit, it was a very, very a fulfilling moment.
Yeah, those tough cases, we need them, because we need that little bit of challenge. We need that little bit of struggle. But boy, then when we finish, we feel so happy, like so relieved, like, wow, that was amazing.
Yeah, for sure, totally. And I think that some of that passion, some of that humility, that's what is important to me to transmit to my younger residents, to my students.
Right. So if you have a young resident who's just learning cataract, beginning, very, very beginning, is there a type of cataract you like to do? 8 millimeter dilation, maybe only moderate nuclear sclerosis. What are you looking for there?
Yeah, for sure. We have to. We always try to have these cases like totally defined for them, and obviously the density of the cataract is one of them. And at the hospital where I'm working, the Asociación para Evitar la Ceguera, which means the Association to Prevent Blindness in Mexico, we have this like algorithm where they these cases for the young residents are about plus two sclerosis and anterior chamber depth around 3 millimeters. But I also add a few important points that are for me. I think there are a lot of techniques that we can learn, and sometimes we are with a mindset that when you start, you have to do a divide and conquer, and later then you can do a stop and chop. But I think there are some cases when you have to adapt to the eye, not just the resident, because sometimes you think it's going to be 2+ nuclear sclerosis, but then you go to the operating room and it's a super soft gummy bear cataract, and then you have to adapt. And that's when I say we're going to do flip and maybe not chop, because we don't need to chop this. This is like a jello, and you're going to aspirate it. Let me show you how easy is going to be this for you if you do the right things. So I think there are some factors that we can observe, but the most important thing for me when we are at the operating room is the this flexibility, this adaptability that we have to have in every single case.
Yeah, I think you're right. The residents, you need to learn all the techniques. Flip it out of the bag for softer lens. Definitely still learn divide and conquer. Learn stop and chop. Learn horizontal chop, vertical chop. You really need to be, you know, sufficiently trained in all techniques. Because like you said, you never know. If you try to divide and conquer and the lens is super soft, you may break the bag.
Yeah, for sure.
Whereas if you flip it out of the bag, and just, you can just aspirate it. It's easy. Yeah. Now it's safe.
Exactly. Exactly. That's what I say. And you have to learn your machine. If you learn how to program your machine, you're going to be totally safe. And that's something that you can do out of the operating room. There are a lot of things that you can learn without risking an eye. So I'm super obsessive and meticulous with my residents to learn those things. For me, it's super important for them to know how the vacuum is going to behave if it's 300, 400, 500. And in I don't know how to say this, but it has to be something that you are considering a whole package, because it's not only the vacuum. It's also the flow. It's also the intraocular pressure.
Of course, it
all works together.
Yeah, I think that's one of the very important lessons for a young surgeon.
Yeah,
you need to know how the machine works.
Yeah,
you need to be able to say, "Here's what settings I want to use, and this is the reason why."
Exactly.
Don't just copy the senior doctor settings. You have to say, "Okay, why do I want more vacuum? Why do I want more flow? Why do I need more ultrasound power? Which phaco modulation I use, burst or pulse? What duty cycle?" You have to understand and know all of that. You just can't start doing phaco with someone else's settings.
Exactly. Well, that's what I say. And for me, a classical progression of a resident coming to my operating room is to, obviously, they have to watch lots of videos. You're going to operate tomorrow. So your homework is to go to your home and watch Cadera Coach or whatever you want. And then I know, then once I know they have started, I like to find out where they stand. Have a short chat with them, see if they had recent complications and which steps they are struggling with. And if the time allows, I try to make them sketches or diagrams and to clarify the key points of the surgery. And then for me, it's so important to create a calm environment. So I never shout at the operating room. I try to stay as calm as I can. But obviously, that doesn't mean that I won't point out their mistakes or the improvement areas, as they say nowadays.
Right. You want to be able to get the point across, but do it in a appropriate manner.
Yes, of course.
Which is kind of just a little bit different than it was many decades ago. It was a lot has changed.
Yes,
I think this is a good move. It's a move for the better. I think people learn better that way. Now, I often get emails from young doctors who say, "I'm really struggling in my residency. When I go to the operating room, I'm stressed out. My hands don't work the way I want them to," and they say, "I don't know if I can do this." And I'm thinking about, maybe I should just quit. Don't do surgery. Maybe I'll specialize in neuro-ophthalmology. What do you tell a young doctor like this who's so stressed out about it?
Well, I think there are some key points for a resident. The first one is to be humble. Humility, this doesn't mean they don't value themselves or they lack of self-esteem. It means having the mindset that no matter what, there's always new to learn. And for them, I think they're good with it because they already have it. They're struggling because they think they're not enough. And the second thing is, to be a good resident, you have to work hard. One doesn't exist without the other. So you can't rely on talent alone. If you work hard, you're going to be better than yourself. At least. So you have to work hard, because what isn't practiced becomes weak. And no matter how much talent you have to work hard. And the third one is skill. But skill is something that has been misunderstood along the years. This is skill is a two-way road. You have to build it, or you have to build it. Some of my students have a huge potential, but I've seen some of them not go as far as others who work hard and stayed home. Mm-hmm. No matter how skilled you are, there isn't a single surgeon who performed the very first surgery perfectly, because these things require hard work. So if you're struggling, if you feel your hands don't respond, you have to work even harder. Sometimes we feel that we are in a very dark moment of our lives, but working hard is always going to make you feel better. So there are lots of possibilities. There are lots of ways of working hard. You can go to the simulator. You can do sutures in a pork eye. You can even, what I always say, you go to the sushi and eat with the chopsticks, eat rice with your non-dominant hand, and you're going to feel better, I assure you.
Yeah, you have to put in the hard work.
Yep.
And I think I like the idea of using the non-dominant hand. Like, you can eat sushi, if you can pick up grains of rice with chopsticks with your non-dominant hand, that's pretty good.
For sure.
It takes practice. No one, you have to practice it.
Of course.
But then also, I like the idea that you have to put in the effort in the wet lab. Some people may have more natural ability.
Yeah.
There's no resident I've ever met who couldn't learn sutures. You can learn it. But you have to then push yourself to learn it better.
Yeah.
And so my rule for learning suturing was, I liked 10, 10, 10. 10 sutures, 10 on nylon, and 10 minutes. In the wet lab, on the pig eye, do it. We'll see.
Yeah, for sure. Even sometimes it's harder to do it in a pig eye because it's a little bit harder. The pig eyes are so resistant, and it's another consistency. So when you get to the human eye, this is easier. It's a softer tissue, so I can go a little bit fluid. So
yeah, I think you're right. The pig eye is a little bit tough. If you want to really practice your capsular exit skills, you try the pig eyes, because the pigs were slaughtered when they were very young. So those pig eyes, that capsule is very elastic. It's tough to do.
Yeah, for sure.
But I think it's a good learning skill. But yeah, I think putting the effort in to learn in the wet lab ahead of time is very important. Watching the videos for sure. Coming prepared. If you know tomorrow you have a case that has pseudoexfoliation, then tonight you better watch a lot of videos about that to learn what are the potential issues.
Of course.
And then the key, I also thought it's very important that every surgery that you do as a resident, afterwards you get a paper and you write down, what did I do okay? What was good? And what was not so good? What was bad? What needed work? What needs improvement? And then you have to make sure that you learn from every single case.
Of course. Watch your own videos. That's super important. I remember during my training days, I used to operate on Fridays. So every Thursday, I'd rehearsed with my band. I was the vocalist. Sometimes I played the guitar or the keyboards. But anyway, I'd get home around 9. And from that point to 12 o'clock, 1 a.m., I watch videos one after the other, sometimes my own videos, of course, trying to understand what I was doing right or wrong. And it became some point where that gives you a whole perspective. My colleagues would often ask me, hey, I ran into a complication. What would you do? You'd probably seen a cataract coach video about this, and most of the time the answer was yes. So I did know what to do. Maybe I didn't know how to do it. So we put it in a brainstorm to fix it, to achieve the purposeful for the patient. But you have to have this background of knowledge when you are facing these cases, even for easy cases.
Right. No, that's for sure. There's so much to be learned. I got to tell you, I still learn every week, because all the videos that are sent to me, I watch, was like, oh, I haven't seen that before. Let me feature this on Cataract Coach. So I'm learning even now, and I finished my training 25 years ago. I still learn every single week. There's always something new.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, certainly the learning never stops. The other thing is, I think young surgeons today, they can learn in 1 year what took me 10 years.
Whoa.
Right? You don't have to experience a phaco wound burn because the phaco tip's clogged. You can watch the video on Cataract Coach or wherever else on YouTube, and you can say, oh, that's what it looks like. When the phaco needle is blocked, you see the smoke sign on the tip. That means I better stop before I get a wound burn. You can learn this without suffering that same complication.
Yeah. Imagine having to go through every single complication just to learn how to fix each one of them. You'd rather go and watch a video.
Yeah, for sure. I think if you put in, that's why I chose that format of just 5 minutes a day. That's it. Mm-hmm. You can watch it when you're having your coffee, when you're, on the subway, going to your work, whatever it is. When you have just a minute, 5 minutes. And then it'll get you one point across. And I think that was kind of my idea, that if you can learn one thing every day, after 3 years, that's 1,000 things you learned.
Yeah. Yes.
And then that becomes amazing. So, yeah, watch one category video a day, just 5 minutes. Or if you don't have time, watch it on Insta, and you can see the same video in 30 seconds or a minute. Highly edited. But then, yeah, you can learn it much faster. It's amazing.
I think every one of us can find room to watch a 5-minute video. I think it's a very achievable amount of time. Five minutes, it's something that all we all can do. So 30 seconds, it's for me, It's faster, of course, but if I'm going to see a 30-second video, I'm going to see not one. I'm going to watch many, 20 or 10 videos, I don't know. But there's a faster and a more precise way to learn, as you say, this is a very fast, fantastic opportunity to the newer generations, and that's why I always think, I always see the spark of the future in them, because they are going to be so much better than I am, and I know that for sure. And even though I'm not that, I like to think that I'm young, but I'm not that young. Sometimes I'm in between.
Yeah, that's for sure. But it's a good journey. It's a fun journey to keep learning, keep getting older. As you get more and more years as a surgeon, it really is just a pleasure. We're very, very fortunate to do ophthalmology. It's really just a blessing.
Yes, it is. It's amazing. It's just a mixture of a very challenging way of life, because you have to fix all these things every single day. When you have trouble in teaching, you have trouble in learning sometimes, you have trouble on your operating room. When you succeed and you look back and you say, like, that's amazing what we can achieve. Lots of hard work and effort, but it's super worthy.
For sure. Now, what is the ophthalmology training process like in Mexico? So is it like US, where you finish high school, then you do 4 years university for bachelor's degree, then 4 years of medical school? Or is it from high school, you do 6 years of medical school? What's the training like?
Well, here in Mexico, when you are around 13 years old, you are junior high school or the equivalent. Then you go to high school from around 15 to maybe 18 years old. And then you go directly to the university. You choose your career and you go straight to medicine or I don't know, architecture, whatever you want. And then you start
How many years is the medical school training?
Medical school training for me, it was like 6.5 years.
Okay.
And that counting the internship and social service, that is around 1 year.
Okay.
But there are different programs, but all of them are around 5.5 years or 7 years for the most extended programs. And then you go through a process that we call an arm, which is the national aspirants for residency exam for him. And then you do that exam, and it's a very hard exam, especially for ophthalmologists. You can go straight to ophthalmology when you finish your medical train, but there are some filters, and ophthalmology is one of the most requested specialities. So you have to have a good result in your exam if you want to become an ophthalmologist. Then they tell you that you passed and you were able to select one hospital in the country, and then the hospitals have their own selection process, where you go through an interview, another exam, IQ tests, and personality and mental issue tests. And every single hospital has their own criteria for the students. That was what happened until this year. This year they changed the way they select students. Now, directly from the CIFRS, that is this organization that coordinates the National Aspirant Residency Exam, they directly send students for one hospital or to another based on the results of the exam. So as from this year, hospitals don't have a word to select their own students. So let's see what happens.
Well, wow, so ophthalmology is then very competitive.
Yeah, for sure.
So then how many years is the ophthalmology residency training then?
The ophthalmology residency training is 3 years, and then you can go to anterior segment or cornea or glaucoma or retina, whatever you want. And for example, anterior segment can be 1 year or 2 years. Cornea can be 1 year, 2 years. Glaucoma is often 2 years. Retina is always 2 years. You can major in your own specialty as much as you want. Even, for example, for retina, there's a new branch called pediatric retina, where they see these cases of
retinopathy, prematurity, things like this.
Exactly. And we're trying to figure out how to perform or to create these new programs for advanced cataract surgery. This is something that we're working currently, and I don't have a date and a specific date, but that's a dream and a thought that we have had for many, many years.
Wow, that's very interesting. So in the USA, similarly, there really traditionally have been cornea fellowship, glaucoma fellowship, retina fellowship, but there really wasn't a refractive fellowship or cataract and refractive. It's interesting that sounds, but I think that's kind of the move now. Now in the US, we're seeing a new fellowship starting, which are basically cataract and refractive for that whole year.
Okay.
And so you're going to start your own fellowship the same way.
Well, that's a dream. That's a dream. We're figuring out how to do it. Within our program, we have our standing professors, including one of my mentors, Dr. Roberto Gonzalez. He's one of the SNI, which means SNI is from the National Investigator System. So he's a pretty big investigator. Actually, there are only three ophthalmologists in all Mexico that hold this distinction. And there's only one ophthalmologist in the country who holds a SNI level 3, who is Hugo Quiroz, with whom I currently collaborate in the development of new technologies. But the curriculum of the course includes lots of things, but I think that we can rely on these big personalities to construct this new branch of the segment. I think it will be something super, super good for the residents.
I think that'll be great. That'll be great for hands-on. Now, interestingly, you also teach not just FACO, you also teach your residents MSICS.
Of course.
Manual extractions. But that's unusual. In the USA, most residents, I'd say 90% of residents for ophthalmology will finish their training doing only FACO and do zero ECCE, which I think is an old procedure I would do anyway, but they do zero MSICS, which I can't believe it.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. But
you're specifically teaching it. Now, tell us why you think it's so important that the residents should learn how to do M6.
It's a long way since cataract surgery started. It's about 3,000 years, and we are always evolving. There's always one procedure that is new, that offers lots of things, and sometimes it's good, sometimes not so much, but certainly we have to give it, we have to give to new things an opportunity. So for me, that's MSICS. For me, MSICS is a new procedure, not so new. We already know that works. So I'm not as adventurous as I would like, but this is a procedure that we know that works. So I struggled a little bit at the beginning because I didn't have this mentorship directly, who taught me how to do MSICS. So I had to learn watching videos. I knew how to do ECCE. So I just migrated from one technique to another. So I was not in a zero point, but it was hard because there's a lot of things different from ECCE to MSICS. But nowadays, I think you have to learn how to do MSICS. If you learn it, you're gonna rejoice in a super confident and super good surgery, a super reliable surgery. You don't need any sutures. You can put them if you want, but you don't really need them. And it's a super fast way to go even to places where you don't have a phaco machine and perform a beautiful surgery, a surgery that's going to give the people the opportunity to see with a very, very low cost and very, very low time in the operating room.
For sure. I think the benefit as well is, you know, even in Beverly Hills, I do at least one, maybe two MSICS surgeries a month.
Well,
and I also, like you, I learned by watching videos. I never had any instruction. No one sat and taught me side by side how to do it. I learned by watching videos.
That's amazing. And your own videos.
Well, now I teach it in my videos because I think it's so important. You know, the case when I did very recently, I was showing you a picture on my phone of just a brunacid cataract. I mean, it was just pitch black dark. So this is a patient, you know, with a weak corneal endothelium. There's some zonulopathy, and the nucleus is incredibly dense. I don't want to phaco that.
Of course.
I can do a nice big MSICS incision, take the whole nucleus out in one piece. I put sutures in the incisions just because I like to sleep well at night and not worry that the patient going to rub her eye or his eye.
Yeah.
And then next morning, the patient's a clear cornea. It's amazing. It's also less stress for me. Less stress for the corneal endothelium and less stress for the surgeon. And so I think it's a really important technique to learn. And if you're listening to this podcast and you're a young or an old ophthalmologist like me, and you don't know how to do it, I promise you can learn it. The videos are on Cataract Coach.
Yeah.
And you will find a case that it'll be so helpful, you'll thank me.
Yes. And this is a very beautiful technique. This is so handy. I love phaco emulsification. That's my everyday technique, of course. But to perform and to do well MSICS is something that you do with your hands. You have to be really good trained with your hands to do it right, to do it beautiful. And I think that's something that if you're a young resident or a young cataract surgeon, you cannot pass that opportunity.
Right. If you have someone in your training program, in your residency, who a professor who knows how to do it, please make sure you learn from him or her before you graduate. It'll make your life so much easier. You will thank me. I use it every month. I mean, I'm so happy. Like, wow, that made life so much easier.
In Beverly Hills, that's amazing. That's
isn't that amazing? Yeah. And I have every machine possible, right?
Not because
I don't have a shaking machine. We have too many machines. I have everything.
Of course.
But there are certain cases where it actually is a better procedure. There was a study that was actually published with David Chang and the Himalayan Eye Care Project, where they're doing these brunescent cataracts. David Chang, who's a great surgeon, does it with phaco chop. And on the other side, they have another surgeon, Sandak Ruit, who does it with M6. They look at the outcomes. Outcomes were better with MSICS compared to a world-class phaco surgeon for those types of cataract.
Yeah.
For a brunescent, dense, absolutely, you know, dark cataract, for sure.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. It's a beautiful technique with so good results, even though they have this study from the Indian Journal, where they studied like 80,000 cases done with MSICS. And of course, the results are super positive. It's an amazing and outstanding technique. I try to teach them at the hospital. I've been struggling with it because I think if you are not open to new things, it's going to be hard for you to accept there are some new techniques, and you're going to have complications with one or the other as you're learning to do one or the other. So yeah, you have to be ready to learn, to identify, and to fix these complications that you're going to have, even though if you're learning to do FACO, if you're learning to do MSICS or whatever you want.
For sure. For sure. I think it's, yeah, learn as much as you can. Because yeah, the challenge is a good, another question for you. Sometimes people say, young doctors say, you know, I finished my training and now I'm operating alone.
Oh.
And then I look, if I have a problem, with the I look to my left and I look to my right and there's no professor. It's just me. How do you mentally prepare? When you're a resident, you have you're very lucky. If your resident is so lucky, if they have a problem, you're sitting right next to him. Yeah. You can rescue him or her.
Yeah, of course.
But then when they're graduated, they're gone. How do you prepare for that mentally?
Wow, that's tough. That's really tough. But I think there's a way. There's a way. You have to have your own inner little professor in your head telling you what mm-hmm. to do. I'm very glad that my students are special for me, and they know, and I know, and there's this relationship that I have with them, and sometimes where they are out there in the world saving eyes, they usually tell me, in some points that I don't know what to do, I always think, what would Rafa said to me? And I think awesome. Everyone, every single one of us should have this mental voice where you can rely on what you know. It's not because it's me. It's because maybe you saw a video, maybe you read an article, but you know what to do. Maybe you don't know how to do it, but there's a start. There's a start, and you have to be prepared. I don't have an easy answer for this, because that's not easy to become a very good cataract surgeon. It's never going to be easy. You have to prepare. You have to study every day. You have to see lots of videos, no, not one or two. You have to see lots of videos, 10 mm-hmm. or 15 every day, especially if you're in your learning curve, if you're a resident fellow or whatever. If you're learning, you have to get soaked on knowledge in order to have it in the right moment. Because there's in my training, there were times where I was like, I know I've seen this video, but I don't remember what I had to do. You have to have it fresh. You don't have to watch them one time. You have to watch them lots of times. You have to be natural with that knowledge in order to, so you can apply it on your patient, on your surgery.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. I think that's a very important lesson to take home. Now, what's it like? You practice in Mexico City, which is the biggest city in all of North America.
Yeah.
What is it like practicing? That's a big city.
Yeah. There are a lot of cataract surgeons, amazing cataract surgeons. Of course, competition is hard. You have to be an outstanding surgeon in order to people choose you as their cataract surgeon. But I think that's challenge, the kind of challenge that I like. Because if you're good, if you love your work, you're not going to feel that you're in a competition. You're just going to feel that you're doing your job. You're loving every day. And for me, that's enough. Of course, there are cities in the country where you can get rich so much faster. And sometimes I say, man, what am I doing here? But I love this city. I love the city, right? Yeah. This is a very big city with a lot of things to do. You have cafes, you have malls, you have entertainment, you have colleagues which you can share and exchange ideas. Big hospitals. We have the three biggest Hospitals of ophthalmology in the country. There are in Mexico City, which are La Asociación para Evitar la Ceguera, which is where I work, Conde de Valenciana, y el Hospital de Nuestra Señora de la Luz. These three hospitals are teaching sites. So there's always something to do. And I like to think that we are friends with these hospitals. We are not enemies, because we always are learning from one to from them. And I think they learn from us. So I love this city. It's a hard mode living city, but I would never go. I think this is the way where I belong.
Yeah, I think the same thing. I like to be in a big city as well. But yeah, you're right. Even whether it's in Mexico or whether it's in USA or any other country, if you go practice in a small town and where you're the only ophthalmologist, you may become busier faster because there's no one else.
Yeah, for sure.
If you're in the big city where just within a few kilometers you have 50 other ophthalmologists, it's a lot more difficult.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. But I think it's worth it. I think it's worth it. There are so many things here that friends, family, there's everything here, and it's super worthy.
Now, one more thing I want to surprise the audience. They don't know, you are also a fantastic musician, but also artist. At this FACOFEST meeting in Oaxaca, there was actually an art exhibit of young doctors and like you who are exhibiting beautiful artwork. How did you get into art? You're incredibly talented.
Oh, thank you, doctor. Here's something. There's some things in your life that are so part of you that you can't just can't leave them. And you have to work hard to keep them in your life. That's not easy, because residency training, ophthalmology, even medical school is hard. And there's always gonna be hard moments in your life. And I don't know, my message for the next generations would be, work hard, stay humble, and never forget that it's from the darkest moments in life that we can see the light most clearly. And for me, that is art for me, because there's going to be lots of dark moments in life. But if you have something else that you can rely on, you have your weights, I have the art. But there's something, there's going to be always something for every one of us. For me, it's art. And sure, I enjoy to share this with my colleagues, which they are a lot. I'm surprised, because when the Congress started and lots of people started to see that we were mounting an exposition, they were like, oh, I like to do that too. I like to paint, I like to whatever. So I'm amazed how many ophthalmologists are also artists. And I also have a football team, so the possibilities are just in your mind. So the possibilities are unlimited. So you can be whatever you want. So just be careful, because you can, as I did, you can get a fracture in your feet, but you'll get well. Yes. Yeah. Yes, painting is safer, so.
Well, one of the paintings I saw of yours that I really loved was, you had a retina fundus.
Oh, yeah.
And you had three panels, so three separate pictures or paintings, side by side by side.
Yeah.
And the first one showed a beautiful, clean retina. Second one was the next part, the part of it that had, like, maybe a moderate amount of diabetic retinopathy. And then the third panel had, like, severe diabetic retinopathy. So that progression was so interesting. And obviously, as an ophthalmologist, we understand it. I think other people may not understand it. But I like how you combine ophthalmology with the art.
Yeah, of course, for sure. That's what I like the most. By now, I don't and don't do anything. I don't do paintings that don't have to do with ophthalmology. That's my passion. And I think there are some ways, some interesting ways to show people something that they should learn through art. And you can go as artistic as you want, because like this one with the diamonds, and they're trying to show how the relationship of the fake needle with the fragments. And I think this is a some kind of legacy that I want to share with the world. I don't know if I'm gonna be able to do this all my life, but I hope so. And who knows what else is gonna it's gonna be painted. But I would like to be an inspiration to all these young doctors, that they're feeling like medicine school is so absorbing, it's so hard that they can't be anything else. You can still be a painter, a singer, a lift waiter, or whatever your passion is. And even if you're lucky enough, you can combine them, you can mix them.
Yeah, that's for sure. Now, I wish I had your artistic talent because it's easy to
Wow.
mix the off you do ophthalmology and art. It's easy. So not all your beautiful art pieces have related to the eye. But
Yeah,
I
of
don't know how I'm
course.
gonna mix ophthalmology and my hobby of weightlifting. I don't know.
It's a little
That's a
bit
tough one.
harder. Yeah, it's complicated.
Unless I do too
For
much
sure.
Valsalva and I get a subconjunctival hemorrhage.
Whoa. Yeah, sometimes it's hard. You have to take care of yourself.
But no, that was absolutely fascinating. And so your artist, your artwork of the diabetic retinopathy, that's a very big problem then near your clinic, right? You have a lot of diabetic patients.
Yeah, for sure. There are everyday patients. Here in Mexico, that's a real problem for us. The diabetes is something that we have in our genes. So we have this with this risk higher than the population. So even cataracts can present in a faster manner. And we have lots of patients with diabetes, so yes, it's a everyday patient, and we always try to help them as much as we can as ophthalmologists. But I always like to give them some advice to take care of yourself, to do their diet, to take their medications the proper way. Because I think there's some mental component that is always hard in this disease.
Yeah, no, for sure, for sure. We used to, in my training as well here in Los Angeles, we had a lot of patients with severe diabetic disease, and they'd present with very complex. The first time they ever see an ophthalmologist, they already have neovascular glaucoma, proliferative diabetic retinopathy, vitreous hemorrhage. That's the first time they're ever getting their eyes checked, and they're coming to you bilateral, counting fingers vision.
Yeah, for sure. And
So it's.
they don't know how to what to do. They don't know where to go, because in Latin America, they are usually very low income people. So there's a health issue that is very important for us, and that's one of the reasons why we do this sort of campaigns, where we go as you know, in Oaxaca. Recently, we did a campaign for low-income people just previous to the Congress. We operated around 70 patients. It's a low number, but there's a start. That's the first
Yeah.
campaign organized by the Centro Mexicano de Cirujanos de Catarata. It's the first one that we do, but we're
Oh
very
yeah,
proud of it.
that's. I like the idea. So before, right before the Congress, come down an extra day or two and do a
Exactly.
lot of surgery to help a lot of patients.
Of course, yes. It's that
Oh, that's a
was
great
that's what
idea.
this is about. Yeah.
Well, I really enjoyed hanging out with you, spending time with you in Oaxaca at FACO Fest.
Yeah, me too, Marcel.
Really. Such a pleasure. You're doing great things. You are definitely one of the future leaders in ophthalmology.
Oh, my.
Keep up with the great teaching. No, I'm telling you, you're going to do amazing things. And I hopefully at another symposium soon, I'd love to do another presentation together with you.
Of course, of course. Of course, my pleasure, Master. It was a great honor to have you here. And I hope that we can hang out some more oftenly. I don't know where I'm going to be there, but for sure, I'm going to be looking after some more presentations together. Take it for sure.
For sure.
Take it for granted.
And then finally, tomorrow, this podcast, as you know, will air on a Sunday. And then on the Monday, we'll feature a video. You sent me a great video. Tell me about this video here, the small and the big video. What's this about? And it'll be featured tomorrow. So if you're listening to the podcast on the premiere day, it's tomorrow's video.
Well, perfect. So the smallest and the growest is the biggest. It's a video about how our approach can be so different in the so different kind of patients. So this is about a patient. This is a pediatric patient who have this eye that is not able to receive a intraocular lens. So we're planning to leave it at a phakic. So we don't need this 2.2 incision. We can do all the surgery through this 1 millimeter port. We need to. And it's a little bit ironic, considering that we have, on the other hand, this MSICS procedure for a elderly patient who need a surgery for a very hard cataract. And we're gonna do this incision around 6 and 6.5 millimeters that don't need a suture. But in the baby that has 2 1-millimeter incisions, we're gonna put a suture for sure, because these incisions are gonna leak the day before, the day after the surgery. So in the MSICS patient, we can construct a certain incision that don't need any suture, even though at the conjunctival plane we don't put any suture. I don't know. Sometimes I think maybe I should put a suture, because maybe the patient's going to scratch the eye. But
they do fine.
We've been lucky, I think. This is a very, very reliable surgery. So we have done great with MSICS. But I think it's very interesting to see this contrast when you... after all these years, we can perform a 2 1-millimeter incision surgery and one with a 6-millimeter surgery, and they are both of them new surgeries, new procedures, and they work good in when they are for the right patient.
Right, because the tissues are so different. The baby eye, the tissues are just so elastic that even that 1 millimeter incision does not seal on its own. It requires a suture. Yeah. Whereas in the adult, the elderly eye, 80-year-old patient, the tissues are inelastic. And as a result, you can make the 6-millimeter incision or even bigger, and it'll seal on its own without a suture. So I thought it was a beautiful video. We're going to feature it tomorrow.
Perfect.
Anyway, I can't believe we've already been talking for 1 hour, my friend. It's been an hour.
Yeah, it's been so fast.
Yeah, just having a good time. So I want to thank you again. And I want to remind our listeners and viewers, remember, we got a new Cataract Coach podcast every single week on Amazon, Apple, Spotify, Google. Wherever you find a podcast, you find the Cataract Coach podcast. Plus, of course, there's a new Cataract Coach video every day. And remember to check out our sister channel, Retina Rounds, where you can find also Retina videos and a Retina podcast too. So until next time, I'll catch you later.